Welcome to Language as Purpose. I'm Eureka Foster. Posta Eureka desu. And I've found happiness and purpose in studying and using Japanese. So I'm here speaking with other people who also have a passion for text or using their language skills to help others engage with the wider world. Hear how my guests are helping us stay more open to what we don't know, and also how language highlights the good human qualities we have in this very technology-reliant world. Today, I'm speaking to certified medical interpreter Alina Fernanda Picayo. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So I would love to know, starting off, kind of what your language is that you most commonly, you know, use, or if there are other languages you use at home, that's great too. But what your language is, and if you can remember what led you to use that language in your work.
Sure. So I interpret and translate for Spanish and English. What commonly happens with Spanish, English-Spanish interpreters is we also always deal with Portuguese, as they are mutually intelligible.
Okay.
So if you're a native speaker, that will, and you work enough, that will, you'll inevitably be around a lot of Portuguese speakers, because you can do a lot of stuff without having to call one. There's a bit less of them. And so what brought me to be an interpreter? It was the pandemic. The first thing is I've always loved anything to do with languages since I was a little kid. You know, I like to teach myself writing systems, how to read things phonetically, any code-breaking things. And when I learned that linguistics was a thing, I was like, oh, great, I don't have to choose a language. But
do you remember a time when you say writing systems,
sure,
just for people listening,
yes,
maybe who don't,
sure,
know exactly what that means? Did somebody introduce you to an alphabet? They put something in front of you that you didn't know, and you thought, what is this? Let me check. The background.
No, I'll tell you. So when we moved to the United States, nobody where I grew up like had computers.
And where did you grow up? Sorry.
In the Virgin Islands. And remember, I'm not like a young person, so not like the youngest. And so then when we came here, my grandfather, he had given us a Macintosh Performa, and my dad had bought this one. He had like one game on there, and it was, I call it a game, but it was for learning six languages, so Japanese, Russian, Portuguese, French, like two other things. And I started then just like learning, I don't know, because it was fun, Japanese numbers and reading phonetically like Russian, you know, so because why not? It was fun.
Why not, right?
I love that disc. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I do it so frequently that actually yesterday at work I was sorting out all the, we do these printouts that are like resource guides, but anyway, and they were all in Russian. They printed out mixed up, and I was sorting
and you
them.
Knew
and
what to do. Wow.
Yeah, I mean, you, if you can at least
at a young age, okay.
You gotta be able to adapt. But the thing that brought me into the interpreting world was, I don't know, it was a interesting thing. I had always so I went to school and everything, right, for linguistics and Spanish. Graduated from the CUNY Graduate Center. Those were my two concentrations. But I had always, so with this idea of loving languages my whole life, I'd said, oh, I would never be an interpreter because that's somebody else's words. I'm only responsible for mine.
Mm. Okay.
And then the pandemic came and I had made another promise to myself, which was I'm going to be a person who graduates from the university and I'm going to have a job in my field somehow, in some way. And I graduated in 2020.
Okay.
And so,
and just for people who don't know, CUNY is
the City University of New York. From the Graduate Center of CUNY. And so those two ideas there, I was like, well, I don't know. I had applied for like this job and I think I didn't realize that it said something about being remote, which is not really relevant, but I was like, okay, yeah. Language,
sure,
interpreter.
Yeah.
That was like, you know, stuff is real weird now with the pandemic. So it kind of was a thing that popped up a few times in like one of my, you know, the online pages where you look for jobs. And I got it. So then I had a lot of fun with it. It was a very, very strange job. And I said, you know, it led me down a lot of different paths.
So those initial jobs or that initial work was serving whom?
Oh, well, you know, so we were serving. So the first type of work I did was what is called OPI. It's over the phone interpretation. Later I then began doing other things, but, it was through a company that they serve banks, hospitals all over the world. Anything you can think of, it's medical, legal, even what we call community, which just means anything in between that can't be described as medical or legal. That's okay. What they call it. But the main question I was asked during the interview was, would you feel comfortable telling a family that their family members have died of COVID? And I said, well, I've never done it, but I'm a pretty caring human, and I think I can do that for you. So,
and that would also help the families greatly, right? I mean, that's
the interpreters that were with these agencies that were doing the VRI, which is the they're like the visual interpreters that you see them on a screen and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. The video remote interpreters, they call them. They often were with clients in the COVID wards, and the clients might have been, you know, dying, and their families weren't allowed in that time, even because of the distance protocols. And so a lot of the time they asked to talk to somebody, you know, on there that they could see and could spend time with when they were, you know, really, really sick, or if they were dying.
I'm glad they asked you if you would be comfortable doing that.
Yeah, I was like, oh, this is a job of the times for sure.
Sure.
So that was the start to I had already been doing like translation stuff before, which is just like with documents, right? Because interpreting is something you do live. That you do it live, meaning it's in the moment when you're speaking. So it became actually very, very interesting to me.
Well, that's also great because now our listeners have a different sets of interpreting terms already that we've discussed on what kind of interpreters there are. There are very many. So,
yeah.
And do you think that you would return to, did you enjoy kind of those medically based jobs, or would you kind of not want to go back to that? I know a lot of people had a very hard time during the pandemic in those fields, and a lot of them have left or said they just don't want to go back to that.
I mean, I've never felt that way. I've always, everything I've done, I do it 100% with my will and with my heart, and it's my choice. And I have always felt that I was the most qualified person to do whatever it was that I was doing in that moment. Because if I was not, then I could have put somebody else to do it in my place. I could have transferred them to somebody else, or I just would not do the thing that I was doing. And those experiences were amazing because me being a person who's quite adventurous, I started realizing, hey, let me mess around with our work app. That's how we go in, is into this work app that I named Interpretatia, because it was like a whole other world.
It sounds like a magical kingdom of
some sort. Well, that you have no idea. It's that's why it was named that. That's why I named it that. And then my interpreter friends loved that. So when I'd go into the app, I like, you know, let me try like going in. They told us our shift is from this to this, but I'm going to go in at night because I feel like it. Or I'm going to go in at like all these weird hours. And then I realized I'd get phone calls from so many different countries all over, from all these different contracts. And I started getting a feel for which time slots I liked. And I would,
wow.
I mean, the only thing I wouldn't go back to is having to work these bizarre overnights just to get the calls that I enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
And that were from really far away, because working at night's not fun. But that was a cool experience, especially because those of us who trained together for that agency, I, you know, made a little group out of them. We became friends. We met each other in person, and we had a lot of stuff to talk about always with each other. And it was a whole world that only we understood.
Do you think that many interpreters immediately have a comfort with each other just because they have so much respect for how hard the job is, or it's really more of a personality thing in terms of who
I think
who you keep in touch with?
One of the things with interpreters that kind of drives me crazy is that I feel like they're absolute lone wolf types and I'm really different. They care about their success, about their, like, it's a very like individualistic minded.
Because you're assessed that way. I can see that if it's a G7 or a finance summit where.
Yeah, I think it's because it's really unique to your mind and how you see the world and how like there's no way to teach somebody else, like maybe your skills, like some basic things, of course, everyone knows some of the same things, but I don't know. I would have to do a whole other thing on that, but they are very much like interested in their own things.
Got it. Okay.
And for whatever reason.
Well, so, I'm glad you reached out and made that group of
yeah,
friends.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun because there's a lot of stuff that happens in these calls and people think, well, it's not in person, it's not in real life, like meaning in front of you. But there's the aspect that, you know, after you get off the phone, you do your thing professionally. There are some things that are quite difficult to have yourself listen to and then repeat out of your own mouth. Things that can be quite sad, things that can trouble you politically, emotionally. There's many things.
Things that will stay in your mind.
Yeah. And it's so then with this group, I basically just kind of wanted us to also have a way to like talk to each other, like, oh my God, did you see this thing? Did you hear this? Like, and
just to vent.
It was great.
Right?
It was really great. Cause then also, as I said, that world of interpretation, which is the term I came up with, it was like nobody would understand. So I wanted with these friends that I trained with to have a way for, I don't know, you know, it's normal. You want to, and especially cause it was the pandemic, everyone's working from home. And so you want to have connection in a way that is meaningful as well.
Yeah.
You know, because it can be very strange explaining to people, like, because when you tell the story of like, okay, this thing happened in this phone call, like people might be like, well, why didn't you say this or why didn't this? I would have this. And I'm always like, I'll stop you at I would have. You have no idea what it's like to do something
in the moment.
Live. Yes, in that moment. Right. And to know I made the best decision possible. Right. So it was good to have other people who were like, never question the judgment.
I think a lot of people say that about a lot of things. Right? I would have done that. Yeah. And it's, well, were you there when it happened? Let's see if we were to rewind. But that's great because in a way, this also speaks to mental health, things that come up in your work with interpreters. I imagine, like you said, there's a lot that might be uncomfortable depending on the job or the client's need. But if you do have a group of people you can talk with about what's going on, that's hugely helpful. Because I do imagine there are some interpreters that go through their own PTSD just having to talk about something horrific. There are experts who work for war crimes tribunals, and that kind of work can be very stressful. Not that any of the jobs aren't stressful.
Sure.
I think a lot of them,
especially
simultaneous interpreting, anything in the moment is. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know how you do that, but I think it's very admirable.
I mean, it's luckily interpreters are very, very strange and adventurous types. So they are always so proud of just like, I don't know, all the ones I've met, and have a real sense of like it's an adventure that's quite safe in some ways.
And maybe they're just a bit more able to sit in the uncomfortable, right? Because they
some
have to
can,
be
yeah.
able to.
I mean, I don't know the experience of other people, but I've never met someone who just like freaked out or who, I don't know, started crying when it's just like, hey, this is not happening to you. I'm sure those things.
I've heard that
those things have happened, but I've never met anyone like that. Like, I don't.
Well, what is the interview process? Like, if you're being interviewed, I would suppose that for a medical job, there are background checks and so forth, but I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, it depends. Like, so let's say, okay, 2024, things are quite different now for interviewing for interpreting jobs than even 10 years ago. So the majority of hospitals, and I'm referring right now to, very specific to New York City and New York State.
Okay.
The majority of hospitals will require, at least a license, like, so that's what makes you a certified interpreter, something that one of the organizations that to accredit you, you know, through an oral and a written exam. So you have a membership to that organization. So they've tested out your skills and things like that. And for legal things, you definitely, in most cases, also need to be certified. Mm-hmm. And more specifically, if it's like New York State and it's for this court or that court, they want something specific to each one.
Mm-hmm.
So they have even more sort of restrictions. But with medical stuff, it can be a little bit easier, but there's not as good of money in it as or decent careers at this point as in legal. They're harder to find. So, but some of the hospitals here in the city, like you go and you interview for them, and the interviews are hard. Like the scenarios, there's a lot of abbreviations, a lot of things that, so anyone hearing this, I hope that they go and study their abbreviations because they are
good
brutal. It's the best tip I could give. It's like, they are brutal. And doctors, in especially like, I'm not going to say the names of the hospitals, but there are doctors who love to throw out nothing in the English language to you, and you're just, or Spanish or whatever, and they expect you to know every version of, you know, terminology. Not always, but in real hospitals.
So what do you do? Scribble it down you can at that moment and go back to it later? Or I don't even know what you would.
No, I mean, they're not going to hire.
You
really have to go very, very prepared. You can't be for hospital interpreting. They're expecting a pretty high quality.
That makes me feel good, though. As a possible patient, I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, no, there's some hospitals that I'm just like, wow, that's almost bordering on crazy. Like interviews I've been to, things like this, that their standards are quite out there, which is fine. But, you know, a lot of your understanding of something just also comes from experience.
Yeah.
So that's why where I sort of disagree with their hiring processes, like where I'm like, if you put someone into a training for a month, you are going to get an incredible, like, just tell them what you want to do. Put them to shadow somebody. You in
that's
less than a month.
That's a good idea. Shadowing would be very helpful.
The thing is, the incredible thing about your mind is if you really have command of two languages, the words will come. The words, you can be taught those things. It's the grammar and the syntax and the cultural aspect.
So on that, right?
Yeah.
Is there anything that you do extra to practice or anything specific that you do? Or is that kind of pointless because every job might bring its own
issue
that day? And
no, I mean, I've done a lot of stuff for like workers' compensation. And I would, for example, if I knew the name of the doctor and my patient, when I say my patient, it's really their patient, but my patient of theirs,
your client.
I know, but we always use it like that. It's a funny thing, I guess, because like we're using the doctor's words. So maybe in that moment they're
and that's patient. What you're supposed to do.
Yeah. I look up maybe like what type of doctor they are, just so that I know sort of what's going to be expected of me, in terms of the terminology. So that's kind of, you know, if I know someone's like, okay, like a pediatrician or something, or if they're a orthopedic surgeon, then I just have a better idea of what they will be, expecting of me. Or, if I get called into the, intensive unit for like the newborns, the NICU, you have a certain idea of, what you're going to be expected to say, you know?
Okay.
So outside of that though, I mean, I think for any job that involves translation and interpreting, you just have to already from the get-go be curious enough where anytime a word, appears in a book that you're reading, nothing to do with your job or whatever, that you say to yourself, hey, I actually don't know how to say this.
I should look that up.
Yeah, and I do stuff like that too. Or if you're like, oh, this is another way to say this. Oh, that's cool. You know, you have to already come sort of curious with those ideas.
I mean, I would also think that, and I'm not trying to assume anything, but this is just speaking with people I know who love text or use a different language for their work. They tend to be people who like to read, or they have a fascination with certain films or radio shows that they follow. today podcasts, but you know, I listen to old radio shows. That's mm-hmm. that's a thing mm-hmm. for me.
That's cool.
And I like watching older films too. So sure. when I've tutored folks or people have asked me how can I make this easier on myself when I have to learn this language? And I always say, well, you've got to immerse yourself in it. And immersion is not just reading it. You've got to mm-hmm. hear it, because you've sure. your ear has to catch even someone who's going at a much faster pace.
Yeah.
And sometimes it can really help also if you need to understand slang or casual speaking instead of formal business mm-hmm. setting. Watching films, mm-hmm. watching current television in that language can help yeah. you greatly. And the reverse side is when I've tutored people who don't know English, for example, or Japanese, and they go to watch a Netflix show or something, right? And I'm teaching them the meaning of the word, and they'll say, but that's not how I saw it used. And I have to say, yes, but that's just because they're turning it into something, because that's what people do in the modern world. But so, would you agree that most, maybe, interpreters, I don't know what the percentage would be, but most interpreters already do have a sort of passion for literature or film or reading, or
I mean, I would say,
or
that
curiosity, maybe not.
I would say that you know, on some level, yeah, because the ones I've come across, and it's been so interesting because I've made friends with very young women, very young men, and much, much older, like mm-hmm. all types mm-hmm. of people, and they're usually quite unusual, especially the young ones, because like I have a friend who I met, you know, two friends who I met through doing the phone interpreting, and they're both like, they know so much about music and so much about just, I don't know, like people that you say, how does one of them who's
well,
like 20,
debatable, it is a language,
but old, I know, but like old, and you're just like, wow, like this person's 20, how did they find the time to read all this stuff and listen to all this stuff?
They made time, right? They
yeah,
made time.
Yeah, they made time. And so there's a lot of, yeah, there are people who tend to be quite already decided and know the things that they like and follow those sort of things. And yes, they do always involve a lot of reading, a lot of, you know, a lot of movies, a lot of, I mean, it would be impossible not to, you know. In the case of one of my friends, she, when she was back in her country, she, as a little kid, she used to love telling stories to the even younger kids around her.
That's good practice.
She has
storytelling.
One of the most fun lexicons of anyone I've ever known. It's like her, it's amazing to listen to anything she says, watching her translate, or even just talking to her, because she's such a storyteller. It's amazing.
So she gets very into worked up, or just...
It's just, she's playful. You know, I feel like in the Spanish language, we tend to, we have the tendency to think someone's quite intelligent based on how good they are with their words.
That's sexy too.
My grandmother says that's how we seduce people in Cuba. That's what my grandmother says. She says, it's the power of your words. That's the seduction.
Well, that's also what makes someone stay in a conversation with someone at anything in life, right? You want to stay because the person is saying something that
it's totally
smart
hot,
or charming or.
So it's a lot of fun. I mean, she's one of the people I could just listen to how she constructs ideas. And when you know both the languages and you're listening to her, you're just like, oh my God, you're so smart.
So can you go into that? So what you mean when you say know both languages?
Sure.
What does that mean?
What that means is, you know, there's not like a machine that you can use to like measure, but command of both languages or of any two or I think refers to, you know, the ability to be they like almost to move within them the same way. Like it's having a very quick, very intuitive grasp on syntax and grammatical structures. It's not something you necessarily learn in school. It's more than likely not. So in some way you might have learned both quite earlier in your life, even if one came first.
So does that refer to how you process words and communicate them back out in terms of not having learned how, you know, from like a textbook. This you're talking about something that's more.
I mean, I would say if you you could ask someone, for example, hey, how do you say, you know, when you make a sentence, say this in this language and then how do you say this in the other? And that person would be able to, even if they don't know a word, they come up very quickly with a close approximation mm-hmm. to the idea.
Mm-hmm.
They have a real, it's what we call having a sense of the word. Like it's the meaning, it's understanding meaning.
Or I suppose
it's not the words.
If they can say, well, here's another way to say it. If it's confusing the person, then they have another way of saying
it. Yeah, it's just you know when someone has the meaning, understands meaning.
Mm.
Because yeah, they could say something a bunch of ways and you would understand its meaning.
Five approximations for
and,
how to say
and
something.
They don't need to know the exact word if they, or they can, but they still, you know the meaning, you grasp it. And it's quite effortless. It's, that's why I say it's often, it has to be intuitive. And it's not, I mean, you just know, you don't have to talk to them for too long in, say, two languages to kind of be like, okay, yeah, you have command of this.
Yeah. I've always thought of comedians also as people who are very good at, maybe they're not doing it in another language, but in terms of approximating or mm-hmm. rephrasing or switching things out, they have a knack.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Yeah, that. Sure, they do. Yeah, that's it's not very different than translation. Being a comedian, for sure, you do, because you're understanding. You have an audience,
mm-hmm.
right? You're targeting it.
You're trying to get
the message,
the point across.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Exactly.
You've got to hit it at the right time.
Yes, of course. It has to be appropriate for the joke to land, right? Mm-hmm. Or whatever you're saying to resonate with people.
So would you tell someone trying to learn another language, it wouldn't hurt to read something comedic in that language? Or that's not so... maybe that's not great training.
I actually... So one time I one time I had said to... One time I said to somebody that I was going out with, I said, you know, if you really want to assess, if you really want to assess your personal understanding of the language you're trying to learn, get mad and express how mad you are, like in the language that's foreign to you. Because when you suddenly have to express how mad you are, you know, when people get mad, they'll go back to the language they're the most comfortable with. Or they go back to the language they can create the most distance from you with, or whatever. There's a lot of stuff behind that. So if I had said, like, as a joke, like, work on if you get mad, express yourself in English, and that should tell you how far
is
along.
The same for sadness too. Sadness would be
sure.
Hard
when,
as
yeah,
well. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, yeah. I mean,
or and frustration, any kind of like. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. I've talked about that, like, with some. I had some friends I grew up with that are Danish. They went back to Denmark, and but the younger one of the two girls, she would say, she was like, when I get mad sometimes, like this is a bunch of time ago, but she was like, I'll just turn into English, like, because like English would protect her in some way, because English was not Danish, so it's not like her native language. She would use it as a tool to like protect her from her feelings. Yeah, there's stuff like that.
To keep distance.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, you've got to be pretty good at both to know what holds you further and what.
Yeah, there are other examples of people who have excellent command of both, but it definitely, it was just an emotional choice for that. Yeah, it's quite common, that one, actually, to pick another language.
That's a good way to look at it. So there are many kids, in the U.S. at least, that are growing up multilingual, multicultural, you know, some of them translate for their parents or family mm-hmm. at home.
Yeah.
Some of them are fortunate enough to go to school and be learning another language from the time they're three, so they will be fluent or have a greater chance of being fluent. And there are also adults who are trying to learn another language, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, but with today, with generative AI extending its reach further and further, there are more and more people who will say things like, you don't really need to learn another language even if you're traveling there next year, because you have your phone and your phone will translate it for you. Even Google can do basic translation mm-hmm. for you. So if someone was coming to you and they needed some encouragement
mm-hmm.
to keep training or to keep learning, what is there something you would say about what makes us humans uniquely capable to communicate or to tell a story that a machine can't capture? I suppose if you're just ordering a coffee, it's not that big a deal. But if you get lost, or even if you are on a foreign street and you want to know, I don't know, the history of that alleyway, mm-hmm. or you know, corridor or main road, I mean, it might help you to know some more words. But what is it about humans that you think that is still necessary?
Humans are necessary because we are human. Agreed. I would never ever tell anyone if they're going somewhere else. I would never encourage them to rely on Google, even if you could take the dictionary and download it offline.
Or any app.
Yeah,
any
I would
app.
Not. Because I would not do that. Obviously, if it's like you can't afford the interpretation services or, you know, whatever Google's going to have to do, or, you know, or Bing or whatever company makes, you know, one of those is going to have to do.
Or would you say, well, at least look up the words around bathrooms, restaurants, so you have some idea, so you can write it on paper. What if your phone dies? What if the machine breaks down?
You know, people have an incredible ability to actually understand each other when they are in a pickle. Like, if they didn't have their phones, which has been the majority of human existence,
right.
Without phones,
right.
We still managed to do a lot of stuff when we needed the bathroom, when we
you
needed...
You can mime it, yeah. I mean, emotion, yeah.
I mean, when my grandma and I go to Chinatown to buy, like, our meat and vegetables, we figure stuff out. Like, a bunch of the people who live in Chinatown don't speak English,
right.
And we don't...
Right.
We don't go there assuming that they should. Like, my grandmother, she points to everything. She'll show you the number, this many of this piece of meat, whatever. Like, it's all good. We all figured it out, and nothing ever went wrong. but I think... the importance of humans in interpretation. It's just when you're speaking to somebody, that person is sorting through a million pieces of information. And when I talk about this, I'm referring to the majority of interpreters. They grew up speaking that language that they are interpreting for. So they have a native understanding, a real profound intuitive understanding from the time their mother cooked them food or their father, or grandmother, like, and they know what spices go into everything. They know the proper etiquette and how you speak to elders or your peers. All these things happen, like all of our polite niceties, all things that come into our culture that happens in fractions of seconds. Our responses, what our expectations are in conversations, those things a computer cannot do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's also tone to take into account, so intonation. There's the moment that somebody hesitates, and when anything like this, right, where you have a sense of something that is happening, why this person won't speak to you, but maybe nobody else is noticing, anything like that. Those small interactions, they're very important, in at least if your purpose in your job, as it is in mine, my purpose in interpreting is to resolve a problem for you. I'm not just saying the words. It's not as simple as just like, oh, you said this word, I translate like this. This one said this, then I come back to this word. I'm trying to facilitate it with the best of my intentions to make this conversation make you feel better about whatever this transaction is about. And computers can't do that.
I wonder if that also would make sense to say, you know, interpreters might also be more empathetic, because if they are working to solve a problem or trying to help you communicate, they probably are people that, as you said, can read emotional cues or even just kind of the way they might stand back or approach.
I mean, sometimes, I don't know, I've also met some that they are
don't
not
fall into that category.
I've met some that you're just like, wow, you're really here for the words. Like, you're not.
Wow, I've never, what a sentence. You're really here for the words.
Yeah, there's a few
that
I find them to be abhorred creatures. They're just really like, they lack imagination. They don't really, they care about doing their job and getting paid for it. They're not really interested in, like, because look, by the time you've called someone to help you translate, it's because something is happening. Something is not working. There is a problem. It's not for fun.
And only that person can help you
solve
it.
So, like, a lot of the times, whether it's with a bank transaction, if it's like medical insurance, like someone is upset about something, someone needs you. They don't need like your, you know, callous attitude about just translating words. And often at that point, whether you get a phone call or somebody walks over to you, someone's already attempted to understand what's happening and they're not, it's not working. So you do have to care, but that doesn't mean everyone does. Especially with like, phone, but that can happen a lot with the phone interpreters, but it can happen in person as well. I mean,
happen anytime, anywhere.
Yeah, unfortunately.
I've heard you say that the language is messy.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if that's about it's almost too much to expect that you can say something exactly the right way or interpret the entire conversation and not. Is that what you mean? Or what do you mean when you say
any linguistics professor I've ever had always said the same thing. Language is messy. It is messy to transcribe. When that's like one of the first things you have to do when you have any professor who's worth, you know,
their salt.
They're worth their salt. They'll be like, hey, transcribe this sentence, like write every utterance. And it's wild. You're like, because then you're listening to everything. Like, oh, you missed one. It's like, what did I miss? You're like, you mean you said to me to try to avoid and I've said I realized just now so many times, but we're not changing that because that's part of
who we are and how we talk and how things go.
Yeah. Or I don't know if someone wanted to transcribe me, there would be a lot of I laugh a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Even when
so do I.
And when something's horrible, I have the tendency to laugh not because it's funny, but because it's terrible. Mm. So there would be a lot of that there too.
I know when I've had to transcribe things, especially with people who have been ill or even if they are older, you know, and maybe they talk more in the back of their throat.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes people swallow a certain way and the word gets lost and I've had to press rewind multiple times.
Yeah.
And back and say, oh, wait, did I catch that correctly?
Yeah. I've done also transcriptions like for school where it was like of a couple minutes of audio of mothers or fathers with their babies. Do you know what's like?
Ooh,
to transcribe,
wait, what does that mean? What?
Like someone talking to a baby, like their baby that's like this sweet, beautiful little creature of theirs. Do you know what it's like to transcribe a person who's just like, oh my God, oh my God. Oh, and they say, I'm not going to get like
aww
fully what it sounds like, but it's worse than when you talk to your cute cat. I mean, yeah, they call it like motherese, you know?
Oh, that's interesting.
Oh, that's a whole other rabbit hole you can go down.
Wow.
But one of the ones I done was one of the girls in my class, her husband, he was really great. And he stayed at home with the baby and he was like, yeah, of course you can record me. And it was just all the sweet things you can imagine. It was barely English.
Oh my God.
It was motherese of the way he would talk to that baby. So it was like, okay, transcribe this now. And that was, there's a lot of noise, a lot of
imagine, but they, in an affectionate way.
They both sounded like they were speaking the same.
Well, that's cute too.
Yeah,
okay,
very cute.
Well, so if we take this back to interpreting, whether it's for I don't know exactly, maybe all the agencies or departments you might have worked for in the past, but on quote unquote serious matters or you know how. I think most people would agree that you've got to be aware of what's going on every day in that situation. But if you were going to work for a government agency, whether it's a city government or the federal government, and you were interpreting or translating, is there anything you can think of that you would have to take extra care or extra precaution ahead of doing that kind of work?
So I have actually spoken about this at a conference I did at BMCC that I did last year.
And BMCC is?
Is the Borough Manhattan Community College. Okay. Here in Lower Manhattan, which is part of CUNY, City University of New York. That one of the types of, for me personally, one of the types of interpretation work that I would not take is work for this country's federal government or because a lot of the work when you're hired as like a linguist or a government linguist or interpreter, in my opinion, it is it can be unethical. So I wouldn't even go down that route because.
Are you talking about the topic or the bias in the way that things are presented?
I'll more specifically. So there are many government contracts that will, for example, I had interviewed for a company that they were dealing with the children in cages on the border, things like this. And I realized that, or they were doing these wiretaps for, you know, for like thing operations for narco activity, things you might say, oh, well, that sounds good. But I'm just not interested in like contributing to putting like Latinos, because I am Latina, like in prison or sort of like getting involved in the political aspect of that with my people in this nation, because we already have so many problems in our own part of the world. And I'm just like, I'll try to do stuff to help, but not to be like getting, you know, I'm not trying to mess up someone's day. I mean, I've always said, I don't know if I help anyone, but I'm not trying to, but I do know that I never hurt anybody with this job. So that was a big thing for me. It was just about being responsible. Like, you know, I'm not going to, you know, I don't want to do anything to.
Is that maybe the one of the things you appreciate most about this kind of work that you can choose?
I mean, I think that this should be the only choice, but, you know, other people, they like the allure of the money or of having whatever position they have. I believe it's very important to be, you have to be very important, like responsible with your words. A concept which is quite difficult, more and more difficult, I think, now than ever, with how freely people say whatever they want, without caring how it affects somebody else, internet or whatever. So I just, I stay away from that sort of stuff. I would rather be not paid well and have to deal with all these strange contracts that are sort of like, I have to go to this hospital kind of far away, or going to the homeless shelter, there's plenty of adventure there.
I'm sure.
Yeah,
I'm sure. And I am a firm believer that all of these different areas, the more diverse the work is that you have, you are learning more about other humans. You are not staying in one lane. And that's it's not a problem if you do stay in one lane. But I do think that diversity is probably help. I would think it would help you not just as a professional, but as a human being.
I don't know if I learn anything, but I don't mean it the way it sounds. No, what I say is, you know, it's very, very strange. Translation is so strange. Like interpretation is, because I always say you have to go in and believe whoever you're interpreting for, whether it's like 3 people, 10 in the room, you have to believe and assume that everyone's telling you the truth about something. Otherwise, you're not going to do a good job if you're doubting them, because then you're not going to want to say certain things, or you're going to hesitate. You're going to try and justify something. Like, then you begin to put your own words into their.
So I have heard some interpreters have trouble with this, right? If you don't believe what that person is saying in their speech or political, whatever, but that's your job. And some will say, well, the job is to interpret it exactly or according to what that person says, because you as the interpreter should not be putting your thought process or switching the words around because you don't feel like it was said the right way. And I imagine that's a very tough, or I don't know, maybe it's not tough because you're already going into it saying, I'm going to interpret exactly what he's trying to say and leave.
You don't know until you're there, because listen, these things happen live, and your reactions, your emotions about it as the person who's
or do you not have time to emote because you're in it?
You have time. Like, you don't know what's going to happen. Like, nobody knows what's going to happen until you're there, you know? And you could say, well, if this situation happens, I'll react like this, or this is you can prepare yourself, but you're not prepared for certain things. I mean, I've had some political stuff come up that I've been like, okay, I've been able to like, with very, very specific things that I won't mention here, but like that I've been like, okay, yeah, I can translate this, whatever, that's fine. And then other stuff where I've been like, oh my God. And yeah. Then I quickly am just like,
I suppose also, you know, at political, like a summit or something, or a labor speech, I've heard that interpreters are receiving the script,
yeah,
at least 45 minutes, sure, before, or that morning. Mm-hmm. So they, yeah, already have a sense. But in your situation, if you're doing diverse jobs and,
yeah, you don't know what's
coming. I think in your position, it's even more of a surprise.
Sometimes you also, by the way, when I say politically, I also refer to sometimes the surprise is how somebody treats somebody else, and you really have a hard time.
You mean in that moment?
Yeah, it's like when I've done stuff like a lot of stuff like between doctor and patient.
Are you talking condescension, or
it could be anything? Like when you feel like sometimes the doctor wants to talk really, really fast, and it's not that you can't catch everything, but they're not interested in even like saying what they're saying to a patient like in a friendly way, that like, I mean, user friendly, like, hey, are you going to understand this? Or their tone is
not helpful to.
Yeah, like it's almost, there's a lot of stuff like that that, I mean, me and my interpreter friends, we talk about what a trip it is to interpret for nurses. We even each had specific hospitals that when we saw them pop up on the screen that we would not want to take, and we'd pass them to somebody else. We were like, hey, I don't take anything from X place because we don't like the treatment of these employees to the clients. And sometimes those things can pop up because they're cultural, between you and them and you. And you'd be amazed how much stuff, issues still exist when you're not seeing the person, and it's still just between voices.
Do interpreters get asked for feedback from the agency, the hospital, or that just never happens?
They say they'll ask you feedback, but they don't actually really care to hear it. Like, they'll be like, they're like, okay, if you have any concerns, they're not interested. They're making money. They don't care. That's
okay. So next topic. So, then not that this is easy, but So there are a lot of concerns once again in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
I know we have folks outside the U.S. listening too, but in the U.S. in particular, mm-hmm, in recent years, there have been more instances of book banning, a few of book burning. Mm-hmm. There are libraries with their budgets being cut. There are also more language programs being cut at universities and academic institutions. Mm-hmm. And I've heard some people say things like, well, it's a community college, or it's a college in the rural part of this and this state. And I'm thinking, then it's even more important, mm-hmm, that it's there, not less important. There should not be any emphasis on that student somehow, that they shouldn't get access because of where they live or who's funding it or whatnot. Mm-hmm. The whole point is that everyone, if they want to learn, the opportunity. But I think particularly in the U.S., we've seen things being shut down or books being banned because of the content, because there's disagreement about, is that content appropriate? I don't want it on that shelf, or I don't want, you know, this in the schools. So it made me think about shelters, to what you were saying,
mm-hmm,
when you've been working with clients in shelters, or maybe I should say folks whom you've served in the shelters.
Sure, in immigrant shelters, yeah.
Yeah, and I should also note that in newspaper articles, frequently you will see the word migrant.
I was going to just tell you.
And yes, migrant does not necessarily equate to non-citizens. But often maybe in that situation it might. Mm. New York City is currently housing many migrants in shelters and hotels, and one particular shelter is on federal land, and that's causing quite a ruckus here.
Yeah.
So if shelters get shut down mm-hmm, in the coming days, months, years,
mm-hmm,
due to political decision making, because mm-hmm, they stand on federal land, or because they stand within a certain city perimeter,
mm-hmm,
how does that affect the need for your work? And I don't know, does it also affect your desire to do that work? Would it make you want to seek out other opportunities to do that interpreting? I don't know.
I mean, I love the work that I do in the immigrant shelters.
Why do you love it?
You know, I don't know. Sometimes I say, I talk about this all the time. I go, I don't know why I like this so much. I say that the only thing I'm good at is being Latina. That's probably not true, but
I know that's not true.
But I enjoy, like, I enjoy being around.
And
Spanish
by the way,
speakers.
I just want to also say that being who you are is probably the most important thing.
Yeah, that's
the most important thing about us all.
I think that for me, like that these places are for me, like they might be the immigrant shelter for them, but for me, it's also a bit of a refuge because it is the place that I can go to, and I know nobody questions how I do stuff because we're from the same culture. I don't have to be looked at strange, like because this melting pot idea. Okay, this thing in New York City, that's great, but I kind of also like staying in my lane. I respect how other humans are. Mm-hmm. I do, mm-hmm. but I also respect the world I come from, and mm-hmm. I want to continue certain traditions and ideas, or you know, and speaking my language, and I don't know, cooking the same food and having the same certain ideas.
Or maybe you can talk about same novel or literature. I don't know if that comes up in a conversation.
There's things like that. Well, I think it's just more how the customs of how mm-hmm. we treat each other, a lot of those things, and just getting to speak Spanish, and that it's the only, and that people look at me, they walk right up to me because they can tell physically look at me that I speak Spanish, and I love that. So, also just to quickly mention, I know people say migrant shelters. You know, I'm a big believer that immigrant's not a dirty word. In the whole world, that's what we are.
Right.
Like,
exactly.
We migrate, which just refers to not knowing which direction. immigrate, you know, but immigrant, that's what, to me, it's not a dirty word.
It's a person, it's a people, it's a community.
And
it's,
anyone can be an immigrant at some point. Maybe.
And many will be, even if they assume they will never be.
Yeah.
And might happen.
Some of them, you could do it more than once in a life. I mean, so it's just, yeah, it's just a thing that happens in your life, you know, and that so I think, what can you do? You gotta.
And it can be intensely happy, by the way.
Yeah.
It's gonna be a very happy situation.
yeah, of course. So, but in those places, you know, so yes, with the closures and all these things, that is something that is, we're not sure what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
I obviously know much more about that world that, you know, I can't say here, but, there's a lot of concerns coming up of the future of these mm-hmm, programs. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I am a big believer in seeing whatever, you know, we call it a mission, this mission through, whether it's successful, not successful is separate. But I enjoy being a person who, you know, I mean, I think my service is really, I don't know, somebody's going to probably not be happy with me saying this, but that my Spanish is not New Yorican Spanish. There's nothing wrong with speaking New Yorican Spanish if you happen to have been raised here. And
I'm so sorry. So New Yorican to you, what does that mean?
Right. In this context, I'm not referring to New Yorican like Puerto Rican or a Dominican or any sort of group in particular. I'm saying New York Spanish. How about if I say that?
That's helpful.
New York Spanish, because I have some of my sisters speak New York Spanish because they were born here.
There we go. Okay.
Yeah. So there's nothing but the Spanish that you speak when you come from one of our countries where your parents only spoke to you in that, and you grew up with all the cultural aspect behind you and that raised you. Not that those things can't be true here, but let's just say everybody surrounding you was, your Spanish is different. That's my point. And so sometimes that can be very comforting for people to feel mm-hmm. that person who grew up and came up like them mm-hmm. In every social aspect. And
Do you get comments, compliments, people you work with where it really touches you, where they say, it just brightened my day, or it really helped because now I'm not confused by what was being said?
Oh, I'm not confused by what was being said.
Oh, I mean the person you're helping.
I mean, people are very... You know, that is another thing. I come home and I'm like, maybe I should keep working in these places. I get a lot of nice like comments and stuff. And, you know, it's stuff that doesn't need to be mentioned, but I get told a lot of nice things. And I also feel like that's something I like too, is that in our culture, it's still okay to say nice things to people. And, you know, and that
that's
it's not.
To hear.
Yeah. That it's, I mean, one guy I was giving some directions to for where his shelter was, he stood next to me and he said to me, he goes, "Your perfume smells really nice." This was this week. And I was like, "Thank you so much." Like, I get so happy when people, you know, I don't know, because I really like this perfume that I wear. So I was like, "Thank you so much. Oh my God."
But there must also be times though where, you know, you are both thinking of a similar word, or you help them find a word for something they were trying to say, where they're just very grateful that you helped them.
I mean, my clients, they learn pretty quickly the New York Spanish words for stuff. Like, I'm just going to tell you, like, this is a word that, I mean, I hope it gets out to the greater public. Mm. Because of just like the pronunciation of stuff in English as interpreted in Spanish, shelter is just officially like when they, like every client, when they write it, it's Chester. Like, as if your name was Chester. Okay. They say Chester. And so that is, to me, the word of the year of
wow,
the
that's interesting.
The Chester. So it doesn't matter how you write it out. That's the pronunciation. So
versus yeah. What? Is there a different word that you
shelter.
Would, you would have? Okay.
But it's or like, you know, at first I remember when people would come in real early and some of the other interpreters would be telling them, "Oh, let me get you like the Metro card." And I'm like, they don't know. You can't say Metro card. Like, you need to say, you can say the card for the Metro, but a Metro card, they're not going to. Because they're saying Metro card, like Metro card. And I said, you say tarjeta para el metro. Mm. Then until, but they learn real quick that they're not going to say subway here. They don't say tren, you know, for the train. They're going to say, you know, I mean, you figure it out real quick.
There are many ways to say something.
Yes.
But to try and get it to the most exact meaning so it's not of just of that area or, you know.
But we have definitely had a lot of trouble with the language learning with the clients because they're quite coddled with our language assistance services. So like with having interpreters always available digitally and that they.
So they do. They have a lot of.
Yeah, because of language assistance laws and stuff that have been around for some time, like language access laws. But it's crazy because I'm like, I never used to say stuff like this, but now I'm like, you need to learn English. Like, someone's not always going to have like on their phone, like this agency.
See,
that's going to help you.
I guess
you.
I just figure like, I know that the information is or interpretation is accessible, but I don't know how many people actually use it, but you're saying yes, people are using it. And
well, that's because we have a very well-paid contract that assists us on a lot of devices. You know, it's always there, but out in the world, it's not, you know, outside here, it's not like that. And I actually see all the time that like this happened the other day, like a guy walk up to a security guard and the security guard was trying to just, you know, gesticulate and sort of telling him where to move or put his things. And the guy's like, Spanish. And I'm like, now they will say to you that how upset, like that you have to speak Spanish. And my clients, when I sit with them, I'm like, look, I'm the first person to tell you all the things about this country and certain attitudes. And I disagree with them all. But you guys need to learn English. Like, this is crazy. Like, you've been here for this amount of years. Like, this is insane. You don't look at any English YouTube. You guys love YouTube, right? Like, you don't watch any. Like, it's people who've come here that are absolutely, like, completely immersed in their world and our language. Wonderful. But it's not doing them any favors because, as you have to learn so you can, like, get by. And I'm not telling you assimilate. You don't need to do this. You can maintain our culture. But you have to be able to speak to your boss. Right. You have to be able to.
And in the same way we're saying, if you're American and you go to another, I mean, you go overseas to travel or like, a visa or something, you should learn the language so
because,
you know.
Right. You're not just a visitor. Like now you're saying that you're claiming asylum or something else. Like, this is like, buckle up, put on your seatbelt. You are here, right? So like you told me, your court date is in a million years from now. And it's so few people that I mean.
So I have not been in that situation, so I do not feel qualified. But to me, if I were claiming asylum in particular, I would be trying to make effort to learn the language, to defend, I guess, myself, because I want to have the most words at my disposal, whether sure. I have a lawyer or not. Yeah, or, yeah. I guess. But
yeah, and especially because you know, all of these documents that go to immigration, they all must be translated into English. So it would help if you knew what was being said, you know, without Google. After somebody's translated it, yeah, you would think, but.
But you're saying that it's not like a money issue. Most people have phones or some other way to yes. learn the language.
It's just a thing inside of people. Like it's.
Do you think it's the same kind of. I don't want to say fear, but sort of an emotional barrier, again, in the same way that if an American were to go to another country and, I mean, any person of any country going to another country where the language is completely different, if you don't make some effort to learn the language, not only would you have a harder time whether you're assimilating or doing business, but your own confidence, I think, might go down.
I think that unfortunately with this particular project and this group of immigrants from the last 3 years that have come in, they've been we've coddled rather than helped in all the wrong ways, and there's no incentive to have to learn English, believe it or not. Even if they're working everything, like, there's very little incentive, and because a lot of, I mean, necessity is the mother of invention, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's the schools that are, like, the public schools are pretty, you know, like, saturated. There's tons of people in there. Honestly, a lot of teachers just like, okay, pass, because we can't be failing everyone, even though we probably should. You know, a lot of stuff has changed. This is where I think that having the interpreters has been and all the language access services has been an absolute detriment to, like, we have not done anyone any favors.
Do you think that people who are of an older generation are more likely to want to learn?
Or, I think
I've always thought it would be the other way around, but
there's not a lot of older people coming in from the last 3 years. I mean, I've seen the data. I see it every day in front of me anyway, but. It's not usually anybody older. It takes really just what differentiates people is just every now and then I have somebody who sits in front of me who's just special. And they are like, nope, I'm not going to struggle. So I'm going to learn this. I'm going to organize myself like this. And it's really up to the individual.
Well, I'm sure you are providing a lot to the people that you help in more ways than one.
I try. We'll see. I hope so.
Well, I really appreciate you coming in today to talk with me. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. I always have a good time talking to you. It's always enlightening.
I will try and put some details about some things that we talked about in the podcast on a page for our community. But I'm your host, Eureka Foster. これからもどうぞよろしくお願いいたします。ありがとうございました。I hope to see you for our next episode. Thank you for joining me.